Now, I'm delighted, absolutely delighted to be joined on the line by well-known broadcaster. I won't call him a veteran broadcaster because he is not a veteran broadcaster. Tom McSweeney. Tom, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good morning and thank you. You're very kind in your initial comments. Thank you.
Tom, we recently commemorated the 40th anniversary of the Whiddy Island oil terminal disaster. The question that, when I knew I was going to be talking to you, that really, I suppose, I wanted to ask was, for those old enough to remember, I think it was you and Derek Davis, the Lord mercy him, who did most of the reporting in relation to that. When you got the call that day to head to Bantry, had you any idea what was facing you?
Not particularly on that day, but it has to be said that that was the culmination of a lot of incidents there had been on Whiddy Island over the years when I was Munster correspondent for RTE. And putting that in perspective, at that time, RTE, it was 1979, I had opened up for RTE a couple of years previously, the first regional base which they had set up to move their coverage outside of just the greater metropolitan area. And I set up the first bureau for RTE. It was based in Cork and it covered the six counties of Munster. A year or two later, they followed with Jim Fahey, who set up the one in Galway, and that's the system that still operates. Although where I covered for the six counties with just myself, there are now three offices in it. And at that time, it was before mobile telephones, imagine, before broadcasts on satellites and that. So it was a much different scene. Whiddy had been controversial because there had been several oil spillages in Bantry Bay since the island was given over to Gulf Oil by the government for the installation of oil tanks. Whiddy being in the bay itself, and the bay is 22 miles long, it's the deepest anchorage you can get in the immediately arriving into European waters from long-haul voyages. So the idea, the interest of Gulf Oil was that they would transship from very large tankers in Bantry Bay at Whiddy onto shore, and then other tankers would come offload from Whiddy and transport the oil into Europe. So that was the setting. But there had been massive spillages, a lot of pollution, incidents and controversy time and time again. So when the call came in that morning, it was a Monday morning at about 10 past one, I got the call at my home in Bishopstown, where I lived at that stage. And no, the first impression was, is it another spillage? But as I drove from Cork, and it's about 60 miles to Bantry, the sky got redder and redder and redder and redder until I got into Bantry. And I was the first reporter in there that morning, and the first reporter for several hours before anybody else got there. It was an amazing scene, because my first attempt was to try to get on a boat to get out to Whiddy Island at the pier, the old pier in Bantry, which was a much smaller pier at that time, because Bantry's expanded a lot since. But the fishing boats coming in had no intention of taking me out or going back to Whiddy. The whole idea was to get off the island. So I went into the town, and it was unreal, ethereal, I suppose you would call it, to stand in the town square and the flames leaping up, which could be seen from Bantry. It's about maybe, the Whiddy is maybe a half a mile or less offshore. And every so often there'd be another explosion and a ball of fire would leap into the sky. And there was real fear in Bantry that morning as people gathered on the streets that something might happen in Bantry itself, that the fire might land into Bantry or whatever. So it was something, no, I'd never seen anything like it before. And no, I hadn't expected anything like that. But it was a sense of unreal and a sense of fear, definitely.
As you said there, Tom, it was pre-mobile phones and internet and a lot of the communication, which is instantaneous worldwide now. But how soon before the actual amount and the devastation that unfolded, how long before that became apparent?
Within a short time, because people coming off the island, and there were about, I think still about 100 people or maybe less live on Whiddy, they knew full well what had happened, the explosions had happened. It was known that the platform, or the jetty as you'd call it, to which the tankers tied up wasn't connected to the mainland. It was known that how many people would be on the island base at the time. And then it was known that there was over a crew of over about 40 on the tanker. And the initial dramatic descriptions of people arriving onto the mainland was that there had been this massive explosion. It had rattled windows, as we later heard, miles and miles away across the bay over towards Ballylickey on the other side. And the word came through that nobody going to live on that. So within a quick, you know, in the more than a few hours, you were already hearing that there were at least 50 dead. I think the unreal aspect of covering that story, reporting it at the time, was that in tragedies, one expects nowadays to see bodies being carried out or people rescuing or whatever. That was a story that in the first days of it, or the first weeks of it even, there were no bodies to be seen. So it was unreal in that aspect. One was reporting 50, 51 people dead eventually when a diver died on some of the work out there. But no bodies to be seen. It was weeks before even one body was washed up afterwards. So unreal from that kind of reportage, because one saw the exploding. We were able to get a plane up later on when daylight came up, and you could see the tanker exploded in two parts, or even by driving out around the bay, as we did that morning, to Ballylickey, you could get with telephoto lens a scene, because that's the side of the island that the ship was on. It wasn't visible from Bantry itself, but you could see the ship in you know, with blown apart effectively and almost in two halves. So not too long afterwards, it was quite clear nobody was going to live in that inferno.
And Tom, I know that hindsight is 20/20 vision, and you know it's easy being to look back and say this should have been done and that should have been done, and we are talking about 40 years ago. But in hindsight, the business that was being carried out at Whiddy Island, we'll just leave it at that, were appropriate safety measures in place? I know you can't envisage this, but you still, you know, you would be thinking that it should be factored into the planning. Was there a sufficient emergency services response for what was taking place there?
Well, there were always questions about the administration, the administrative way in which Whiddy was being dealt with. As I say, over the years, there were so many incidents of spillages, difficulties, problems, controversy. But you had to put in perspective also, Whiddy provided quite a lot of employment in the Bantry area. Bear in mind, there were tugs in the bay. Tugs were coming from Cork Harbour to service Bantry. There were tug crews. There were pilots being used to bring the ship in. There were crews on the vessels going in and out, servicing Bantry and Whiddy with things like provisions and so forth. Then there were the staff in Whiddy itself, and then Gulf had offices also in Bantry. And also Whiddy held the strategic oil reserves for the whole nation, the whole Irish nation. These strategic oil reserves were there on Whiddy. That was part of the deal which gave Gulf the island. So a lot of questions raised, certainly. But I think in the aftermath, there were the aftermath, and then there was the inquiry, the investigation, the tribunal which examined it. All of these came to light that there were certainly major issues with safety, major issues with administration. And it has to be said that to this day, there is still a lot of questioning. People believe that the truth was not fully told at the inquiry. People believe that there were stories made up to cover up aspects of it. And I tell you a thing that struck me very forcibly when I was down at the 40th commemoration there. There was the mass first in the church, and then Michael Kingston, who is a very well-renowned international lawyer, has been given a lot of awards internationally, highly regarded by organizations such as Lloyd's Insurance, which would be the big, big oil and ship and cargo, etc., insurers around the world. Lloyd's List is the Bible of newspapers, published for, you know, hundreds of years. now on digital only, but it will be the definitive aspect, and they all highly regard this man. He was 4 years old, had just celebrated his birthday when his father was killed in the Whiddy Island Betelgeuse disaster. And he's run a campaign with the people from France whose families still mourn their people who died, and many of them, remember, have never had bodies to mourn from the tragedy. And there is still a Betelgeuse relatives, family association. They're campaigning for what they say needs to be brought out even 40 years later, the truth, as they say, of what happened at Whiddy. And at the mass in the church in Bantry, he made a very powerful speech maintaining that there should be an apology to the people from the Irish government for the maladministration, as he views it, of the entire situation. But I stood at the memorial there as 40 wreaths and more, 50 wreaths maybe, were laid by various organisations the day of the commemoration. Now, the media gets, and more the normal media run, you know, they're very busy getting onto the bulletins and so on and so forth. I stayed to hear the whole surrounding because I wanted to record bits of it for my own radio programme. And there was a lady, a French lady, whose husband was killed. And normally commemoration ceremonies are quiet things, you know, quiet, somber. This letter that was read from her about the tragedy, it excoriated, and I use that word, excoriated most strongly the handling of the whole thing, the investigation she was unhappy with, things that went on. And she named people whom she believed had been responsible for the death of her husband. I reckon I was the only journalist still there listening to it, because the others had all gone about their business and the ceremony had gone on very, very long. But it was extraordinary to listen to the angst, the angry feelings, the bitterness that is still there. And it struck me, as I've been saying since, that this hasn't ended for many people. It's still a very great story, even 40 years later. So were things wrong? Yes, without a doubt, yes.
And the thing about it, Thomas, as we know, indeed, to our cost in this country, we are very, very good at long-fingering, and we have several instances of that where we are now starting to investigate things which happened 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago. So hopefully, for the relatives of the victims of the Whiddy Island terminal disaster, that somewhere the truth will be unearthed and made public. Tom, you mentioned it there in passing, your own programme, This Island Nation. It is a terrific venture, and may I congratulate you on it. And while we're discussing it, can you tell me what you've coming up on the next episode, please?
Yes, thank you for that indeed. Yeah, I have to say it's a tribute also to the Community Radio Network, if I may put it like that, because when I left RTE, I had decided not to broadcast anymore. I finished my broadcasting career as I viewed it, and I went back to writing. But I was I was encouraged on to CRY Community Radio in Yall to do a maritime program, and then it gradually spread across the airways. We have about 12 or 14 stations now broadcasting it. I think what encourages me greatly is the response I get to people who email in with items or suggestions or whatever, and your own station contributing pieces to it. So I like this aspect of community. I've always felt there's a community of the sea, which a family of the sea, which you just need to build people's understanding, because this island is surrounded by the sea, and we can't get anything in. Nothing comes in without a ship carrying it. I keep on saying, you know, we occasionally broadcast on the program, what would we not have? What would we not have if we didn't have ships coming to Ireland? And you can answer, we wouldn't have oil, so our cars wouldn't move, our planes wouldn't fly, our electricity wouldn't work, we wouldn't have things like oranges, bananas, fruit, wine, you name it, the cars that come in, they're brought in, they wouldn't be existing. So we keep on making this message, and that's the message we carry, you know, we try to carry across the programs. Among the next ones I have, we'll be doing one on Whiddy and on the Betelgeuse, and talking to Michael Kingston, this lawyer I told you about. He was very emotional when I talked to him at the memorial obviously on the day. That'll be one of the items. And then there are other stories we're doing. People, as I say, come across with stories. Dublin Port is one that features. It's a port which has been trying to rebuild itself a lot into the community. And the most fascinating people I find in Dublin are people like the Dublin Dock Workers Preservation Society. I've done a few programs with them and will be doing one or two more with them. They've been recreating the entire message of how the dockers were so important and the dockside communities were so vitally important to the community in Dublin and building around that. You know, the stories come in and they show me still that there's a life and a great interest in the whole marine scene, the whole maritime, it goes across so much. And one of the people I interviewed, whom I'll be in the second next program talking to, is Dennis Murphy, who's the manager of a vessel that you'll probably know in Dublin, the Rin Voyager, which is a sailing project begun back in 1993, helping those who may have been unskilled school leavers, those who've been in trouble, rehabilitative program, helping people who've had drugs problems, and through the community aspect of using the Rin Voyager to take them to sea, has, you know, shown what the maritime community can contribute towards the community at large. So then he'll be one of my main subjects, and I think the story of the Rin Voyager, it fascinates me, and it underlines, as Dennis Murphy quite clearly makes in the interview I've done with him, he tells just how he makes a point about what the sea can do to change people's attitude, to get them to recreate themselves into the community. It's a fascinating story.
And Tom, something that I might touch base with you again in greater detail with later, but we're hearing now this initiative, which I presume as two Corkmen we're very proud. It was launched in Cork, Clean Seas or Clean Oceans.
Yes, it's very important. The amount of plastic in the oceans and the amount of debris comes in. I was dealing only in the past, the very recent past, with the offshore islands, which islands like Arran, Clare, Achill, and so forth. But particularly Clare Island strikes me, particularly because they sent me a photograph from Clare Island of a traditional, a version of a traditional cottage, a mini example of it, which they had built from plastic bottles arriving on their shores. It's this thing, you know, hundreds of them. The amount, I suppose because they're the greater extremity of Ireland, they're seeing so much plastic now arriving on their shores. It's huge. Now, I know the minister launched in Union Hall, he launched this Clean the Oceans, asking the trawlers, but that did not impress me personally a whole lot because of the fact that since 2015, which is 3-4 years ago, fishermen have been doing exactly that in a program called Fishing for Litter. They've pulled out about 300 tons of rubbish from the oceans, landed them into about 12 ports which take part in it, and they dispose of what they've got, and a lot of that has been plastic. I viewed that, it was very nice to see the minister, you know, but it looked to me like a big PR stunt, to be very honest, which was already being done by the fishing industry for the last 4 years, but the national media, which takes very little interest in the marine scene, unless there's a tragedy, God knows, unfortunately, hadn't reported much of the entire fishing for litter project for 4 years, but when the PR stunt came, it was all over the place. So there's a lot more than just asking trawlers to clean the oceans is a bit incongruous to me, because there's a lot more going into the oceans and a lot more usage of it, marine leisure, ships, God knows, and most of the litter comes from the shore anyway.
And Tom, moving on from that, because it's something that I wanted to ask you about because of your in-depth and incisive knowledge when it comes to our waterways and indeed our coastline. Do you think our government, and particularly I suppose our Department of Tourism, are doing enough to maximise the potential that lays there in relation to the tourist industry?
Well, I would say generally there's more awareness of the sea and the oceans now than there has been many years ago when I first started covering the marine sphere. A lot of extraordinarily good work has been done. I would cite, for example, the Marine Institute in Galway and the discoveries which they, you know, showed during the year. It raises awareness of just what it is that we have. It also raises what we've lost. If you think of what's been given away by governments over the years, and I think particularly of our fishery waters, which is an appalling example of economic failure of the worst kind by ministers and politicians in the past, who we are now unfortunately stuck with huge losses. When you think I think of fishing ports like, you know, Castleton Bear in West Cork. You see these foreign vessels landing in huge amounts of fish going into lorries straight off to Spain and France, and very little, not enough economic benefit coming to Ireland. I sometimes think when you talk of tourism, do all many tourists which head to Spain, for example, every year, and say how much they love the fish dishes they get over in Spain and how well the fish is done, that the great majority of that comes from Irish waters, but it's not benefit to Ireland. So there's been a lot of failure. I think things have changed. The Marine Institute has risen awareness. There's a lot more awareness of what we have. Do we utilize it properly? There's still a long way to go. Why in an island nation do we not have a maritime department? Why is it within the Department of Agriculture and Food? Is agriculture more important than marine? I have questions about that aspect. Too many aspects of the marine sphere. Why are parts of the marine sphere in about three different departments? You have them in the Department of the Marine, but you have inland waterways in another department. You have the fishing, the angling in another department. You have the sport of sailing in the tourism and transport department. The Coast Guard isn't under the maritime sector, it's under the Department of Transport. So I don't think politicians are dealing fairly or adequately with the marine sector. It certainly is not a high enough department within government of an economic value. They do not see still the economic value. They're beginning to be worried because of the whole Brexit by saying the ports, coming back to the point I made, that we can't get anything into this country. 95% of our exports and imports move by sea, but it's only now reality is beginning to dawn on a neglectful government. Have they done enough? No. Are they doing more than they did before? Yes. Should they do more? Absolutely. Our inland waterways? Absolutely. Beautiful, beautiful resource. Our angling, the biggest sport in the country is angling. People may not realize it, but it is. It's the biggest sport in the country. Does it get enough support? No, not in my way. Have we enough marinas around the country for motorboats and yachts and everything to move from one? No, we don't have enough. Is there enough concentration on that? No. Is planning properly done? Absolutely not. So, no, big failures, but advances also. More awareness, yes. More concentration, yes. More awareness of the importance of wind, of wave power, yes, very good. More importance laid on wind power at sea generated, yes. So some good things, but not enough still. And overall, absolutely not enough awareness by government that we are an island nation.
And on that note, Tom McSweeney, broadcaster and generous to a fault with your time. Tom, thank you so much for joining me. It has been a pleasure and very, very informative. Thanks, Tom.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for the invitation.